Welcome to Arts About, a show about art that's a work of art in itself. I'd like to point out that I am not Sally Bailey, but you are Mark Stewart.
I am, apparently, yes.
And good morning to you.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Brody. Welcome back from La France.
And good morning, Brody, behind the curtain. Now, this morning, Mark, I'm going to a little bit later on, I'm going to talk about a lovely day sailing. But before we do that, I want to talk about the show at Bed Square, the 1990s Melbourne show. We've both seen it, and I think we can probably spend a little bit of time talking about it.
This is the show called
A Brilliant Eye, which is a Died Pretty album title.
Which I think might come from Blake, maybe?
Okay.
Originally?
So there's a profound thread even in the titles to shows, you know.
That's about as profound as it goes.
I thought you might say something like that. I reflected on all sorts of things whilst I was in there. Partly, I was in Melbourne at the time, during the 90s, and I saw a lot of this stuff in the galleries that it was originally exhibited in, a lot of the stuff that's on the walls in there. It's interesting that your mate Christopher Heathcote made the remark at the time.
Christopher Allen or Christopher Heathcote?
Christopher Heathcote.
No, my mate's Christopher Allen.
Okay. Well, there's a critic called Christopher Heathcote who made the remark at the time that a lot of the art that he saw around him in the 1990s would pollute the walls of museums in the future.
If it was lucky.
Right. Yeah. Did he get it right?
Well, it has in this case. Look, it's really difficult to... I'd rather be positive after seeing this exhibition, but it's impossible, and I can't be. As you know, I wasn't here in the 90s in Melbourne or Australia, but I think it's a case in probably most countries in the world. You look at the art from the 80s or the 90s, which was avant-garde at the time, and it seems so terribly passé now.
Well, I was going to suggest that it's much like anything that was going on anywhere around in the world, really, at the time. I found some... I was able to find some of it quite interesting in different ways. I mean, there were some works on paper in there, a set of, I think, eight various artists, and they were very graphic, and in the sense that they were just designer pieces, you know. And interesting, I suppose, because of their intellectual vacancy, you know. They were beautiful to look at.
Do you have any names?
I can't remember the names of the artists. It doesn't really matter. But they were black aqua tints from a variety of artists. And there's a row of them in there. And they're beautiful to look at.
But they're the ones in the darkened room.
One spare to think about. And there's all that stuff from Gordon Bennett, which is kind of the opposite. It's sort of very intellectual, but has an aesthetic vacancy that is troubling.
Is he indigenous? Yes. Yeah, I remember he's dealing with the all the problems of the past.
Yeah.
Once again, an example of politics not
well, really. Very confronting sort of way that his approach, but ugly, I think. Mm.
That was probably the point of for me of the whole show. No beauty, absolutely. You're nothing of any sort of astounding beauty which stood apart from its time.
Yeah, I don't know. I know you didn't like Patricia Piccinini's photographs. I thought they were quite beautiful in a sort of a spooky, creepy way.
They just look like trashy, bad fashion photography.
Yeah,
mixed in with sort of very low quality technique.
Well, it was the 90s, so they didn't have... The Photoshop techniques weren't as sophisticated as they are these days. And in fact, you can see it all through the show, that the lack of technical sophistication, which is interesting. It's not that long ago, and yet there is a lack of it. It brought to mind, Robert Hughes's remark that... and again, Hughes remarking on the 1990s... and saying that what was missing in the 90s was the spectacle of skill.
Mm.
And That's certainly true of what's up at Fed Square at the moment. There isn't a lot of skill involved in...
Well, no, not even Bill Henson. You see his photograph.
The ripped-up collage.
Just messy. And the sort of stuff that ages very badly. A lot of the stuff in there has already aged badly.
Yeah, but it's you can feel the...
just the medium itself, not even the idea.
I could feel the studios, the Melbourne studios this of the is, time. The,
yeah, this is your nostalgia.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Which is, for someone like me who wasn't here, it just looks like some sort of, it just looks so parochial. It looks sort of local. Okay, let's talk about the local movement.
Crudely made, a lot of it.
Very crudely made. You're very much in the moment of the 90s, I guess. And right. Yet there's absolutely no resonance in the... And this is a really big question. How it's like I was talking to you about a book of 60s sculpture I have and how it all looks like each other and it's all stuck in the 60s. A little bit of Robert Klippel manages to escape, but otherwise things get stuck in their time, and I think it's really something you have to be very careful of. Now, the other problem, of course, of this show is the creator, whose name is Pip Wallace, who's done the best of her abilities, but apparently she's very young. She wasn't even she was a 10-year-old during the 90s. So
well, she was a teenager through the 90s, I gather.
It's once again a very good example of a created show of putting too many different disparate things together and not coming up with a whole. I mean, as in with something whole. It's more hole.
So conceptually, there isn't a problem with her putting a 90s show on at Fed Square.
There is definitely a question. Just the idea of a 90s show already doesn't feel like it has any... it didn't resonate with me at all. Who do we know from the 90s? What artists do we know who've continued
well,
on?
Well, the parochial nature of the show is interesting to those of us who were here. There's not
many of you, are there?
Well, there's one
really?
Of me.
I mean, if you think about the people, the listeners, how many people are going to say, oh, I want to go and see a 90s show at Fed Square? I can't imagine there's that many.
Were there many people when you were there? Were there people in the show?
No, there was nobody. Right. There was no one. There was a couple of Indian Sikh guards.
Right. Did you sit down and play the guitar?
I didn't see. Oh, no, of course. No. I'm not going to get involved in that. I don't like participatory things. I walk through and just sort of try and find if there's something, a little bit of mystery, a little bit of silence to it, something which is going to bring me in. Mm. And it's very difficult in these group shows.
I wonder about some of the work. There's the... there's a large work in there, and again, I don't know the name of the artist, but it's a large section of wall which has got a kind of a pink electric tape stuck all over the wall in a grid pattern.
It's not tape. No, it's drawn on. I read that one. It's right. I forget the woman's name. She's very much influenced by Sol Lewitt.
Right.
Who
it's drawn onto what?
Onto the wall. Yeah. And it's drawn on by the curator staff. It's not done by the artist.
Yeah. So every time they want to display that work, what they have to do is get someone else to do it. The artist doesn't do it.
No, it's not as if they have to get somebody else. Anybody can do it. Right. And they can do it within a certain the dimensions.
Right.
And they just have to draw a straight line. And so it's anybody can do it. And it, the idea is that it's slightly different each time it's done. But it's completely and utterly taken from Sol Lewitt, who was doing these wall drawings. Very beautiful, but he'd do whole rooms and whole museums, but he'd just draw them out and obviously get assistance to do it.
And what about the Ricky Swallow? I quite like the Ricky Swallow
stuff.
Which
one is that?
Ricky Swallow had a couple of, there's a couple of little record players.
In
glass boxes.
Yeah, with the guys playing games.
Yeah, video arcade.
It's cute, it's cute.
Yeah.
About it.
He also made the Darth Vader head, which was sitting on the floor.
Horrible.
Yeah, I thought that was quite horrible too.
But the piece I really enjoyed was the Sally Smart, who did the cutout on one of the back walls, and it was a cutout like a bed and sort of some organic shapes, and they were felt and a bit of wallpaper, but it's Just not a not a successful show.
Any of the video catch your attention?
I don't look at videos.
No.
Except the one of the in the McClelland of the those ants done by that girl, ants in Colombia pulling the leaves apart.
So if you don't look at them, how do you know there weren't more ants?
Well, I hear them. And then
you might have missed something, Mark.
Well, no, I didn't.
No, well, I wouldn't be able to help you there because I would have missed it as well.
I know, I did see the video of some party in probably Fitzroy Street, all these drunken people in the 90s.
Oh, the nightclub. Yeah.
The nightclub, just horror.
That was the nightclub I was trying to get into with the ladder,
I'm sure. Yeah. Would have been more interesting if you'd been there with your ladder. It's really difficult to look into the past like that and just when you see the people having fun like that, it doesn't resonate either. There's no...
There's an element of fun to it. There's an element of being allowed to the whole thing, which is what the mood was at the time, I seem to remember. And there's also a kind of a clumsiness, which is across pretty well all of it. Not all of it, but most of it, I would have said, has a sort of a crafty clumsiness to... therefore, the lack of skill, And
I think you nailed it by fun. And I think that idea of your people having fun and enjoying themselves doesn't really have any significance afterwards. It doesn't have any, and you can see it in the art. It doesn't have any substance to it at all.
Howard Arkley painting, I thought, had a fair bit of clout.
Yeah, that's probably the only one, wasn't it? And even that, it's Howard Arkley. They're nice, but they're they're really just acrylic spray paint paintings of house fronts.
Yeah.
When you think about it, you can't really talk about it too much, can you?
Well, it depends on if you live in Melbourne or not. All of those suburbs with those bungalows and the little lawn and the little low brick fence
and the hills hoist out the back.
And it's mind numbing. How much of it there is, and Howard was onto that. He was right across it, but also the furnishing and all that sort of stuff.
Interesting, isn't it?
For someone who was a crazy junkie living in a warehouse in Melbourne, that was like making paintings of Mars, and I'm sure he enjoyed it.
Well, look, take a photo of a house and spray paint it, colour it in with spray paint. You're onto a good thing.
Yeah, but Howard's already done it, Mark.
No, I'm saying that's what I'm saying he was onto a good thing.
Do you think
thing.
It was a photograph?
Of course it was. He wasn't out there drawing houses, do you think?
Yeah, I think he was, actually.
I'm sure it's not true, John. A junkie's not going to go out
and
draw.
He was a good draftsman.
Oh, good. I'm sure he is. But no, I'm saying his system was wonderful that he could just colour in a house front and make
Well, he went from spray painting to dots, and the one at... the one at Fed Square at the moment is a pixelated sort of painting a la Lichtenstein and quite interesting. There was another painting in there that I liked kind of vacant in an intellectual sense, but attractive in an aesthetic sense, which was the Dale Frank. I quite like those pictures with all the wet paint all over them.
Well, it's it's house paint.
Yeah,
that he pours. I've done enamel. A few myself, where you just pour it onto the flat. It's lying flat, and you wait till the colour it mixes up itself, and very beautifully the way that it's like petrol fumes on water. You see all those rainbow colours. It's just and he's done a very similar thing, and he's done it quite well. Let's see how they age.
A bit like Jack the Dripper without the frenetic choreography.
Well, yes. Apparently, it's keeping a lot of restorers in really good business.
What, Jack the Dripper?
Well, all of them.
Or Dale
Rothko
Frank.
As well. All of them. All the people have used a lot of house paint.
Right. Dale Frank also had a set of four bits of wallpaper in there. Did you see those?
Yeah.
They weren't unattractive.
No. He's not a bad artist. I don't know what he's doing these days, but he's done some good things.
I think he's still doing what you saw the other day.
He couldn't still be pouring house paint.
I think he is, man.
Oh my God. All right. Well, look, good for him. Hope he's getting some good waves down at Lawn.
Now, how are we going there, Brody? We're ready to... I've got a track of music I'd like to play. I never get to do this. And here's my chance. So I've got a button here to push, and then that's where we'll go. That was Lucinda Williams, Mark. Lucinda Williams is quite well known these days. She would, for a long time, I don't think she was very well known at all, but she's a sort of a blonde-haired Texan junkie cowgirl, country and western singer, plays the guitar herself.
That was her playing the slide guitar. Yeah, not bad. Good. All right, so you ready?
Ready for what?
Well, meth heads and murderers.
Okay.
How the Third Reich's conquest of Europe got a chemical boost.
Very good. No idea what you're talking about. Let's go ahead.
I'm talking about the Nazis, and it starts off by, I'm quoting, General Heinz Guderian, "I demand that you do not sleep for at least 3 days and nights if that is required," he said to his thousands of German troops who were on, had massed on the Meuse River before pushing into Belgium and France. The largest motorized unit in military history had assembled, comprising 41,410 vehicles and including 1,222 tanks. Its goal was to reach the French town of Sedan before the French army did. However, only by fighting nonstop for 72 hours would that be possible. As he said, General Franz Helder, "We have to resort to unusual means." That meant drugs, specifically methamphetamine. Was that, how do you say it?
Methamphetamine.
Methamphetamine, which is ice, is it not?
Yeah.
Okay. So apparently on this particular night, a supply of 20,000 pills were distributed to the soldiers who collectively consumed the entire stock during the course of the night. 20 minutes later, the nerve cells in their brain started releasing neurotransmitters. I won't go into that, but they were getting pretty high. And they went through and they absolutely murdered the French and got in the 3 days. Apparently there were a few heart attacks on the way. So they managed to do this, and some of them kept awake for 17 days.
Right.
On ice.
Nazis on ice.
Nazis on ice, you can imagine. And it was going through all the way from the foot soldiers to Adolf himself.
Really?
Oh yeah, he was high for a very long time. Apparently at the end there he was getting, let me see,
not like Brett Whiteley high though.
He was
Adolf Hitler high. That'd what he be was a different
he,
high.
He did a few watercolors, Adolf, as you know, which are apparently worth a lot of money these days. He was a failed artist, you know. He was trying to sell tourist cards in Vienna and couldn't sell them because they were so bad, and that's when he decided.
I have pointed that out to people who are doubting whether or not they want to buy a painting off me, pointed out that Adolf Hitler was a failed artist. You know?
Yes, well, unfortunately, there have been many haven't gone out murdering people just because they couldn't sell a painting. So I've got to find this. Hitler was being taken.
So where are you getting this from?
This is an article out of the Weekend Australian.
So that the Third Reich was on ice. Is that what essentially what you're saying?
This is what they're saying. There's a book that's just come out, which is, here we go. Adolf's physician, Theodore Morel, was administering 28 pills a day at one stage to Adolf, in addition to a barrage of injections, scarring his patient's arms where the skin was perforated. As the pressure of losing the war mounted, Hitler's physical decline belied his unrealistic drug-imbued optimism, and he began experiencing tremors. Poor thing.
Yeah.
But apparently all the Spitfire pilots were taking them, which they managed to stay up in the air for longer.
Yeah.
And they were all pretty high.
Right. So JFK, of course, was...
also, but he was painkillers.
Yeah, he was on downers for most of his presidency.
But then so were apparently Andy Warhol's amphetamines for all of his life, especially after he was shot in the stomach by that girl.
Right.
Whose name I forget. But if you think about drugs, prescription drugs are much more prevalent in the States than they are in any other country.
Which reminds me, Mark, of my premise, which is that if there's going to be drug testing in sport, there should be drug testing in art. And they should drug test all artists. Anyone not on drugs is out.
Well, that would be you, John.
Yes, it's true.
Yes, I think my father was an Australian veteran squash champion, and I said, "Do they do drug testing for veterans?" He said, "No." I said, "Yeah, they should." He said, "Yeah, you're right." Anyway, so moving on to Apple.
Apple the company.
Apple the company, who's, it's the 10-year anniversary of the iPhone.
Don't you wish you could go back 10 years and just buy a few shares?
No.
No?
No, no. Wish I could go back 10 years and do other things, but right. I wouldn't be buying shares. On the 29th of June 2007, the first iPhone came out. There are now 1.2 billion iPhones in the world.
So that was the little sort of round back ones. They were quite nice.
Yeah, that's small. Yeah, I can't remember. Didn't have one. I refused.
An iPhone 3 or something.
And so two-thirds of Apple's $216 billion in sales came from the iPhone in 2016.
Beautiful bit of design, must admit.
And it's still going. So what they're saying is that for Apple, the next iPhone will be the iPhone, which is basically what we're doing. We're just buying the same thing with a few little extras, like with cars. So it's a perfect consumer model. But they're going to bring in AR, which is augmented reality. So what that basically means is that it's like with the when they started doing the
augmented reality, not virtual reality. Augmented.
There's two. There's augmented and there's virtual. So the augmented reality, I'll give you a perfect example of that. This is going to start off a whole new wave of apps, because when they brought out the first app store in 2008, that created an enormous business for a lot of people, as you know, building apps for everything. And it's going to be the same for the augmented reality. The first example is IKEA, or however you say it in this country.
IKEA.
What you'd be able to do is they're working on an iPhone app that lets users point their phone and see what furniture looks like superimposed in a particular space.
Right. Okay. So you take a photograph of your lounge room,
and you can fit you can go onto the app, and you can you can look at the couch and then to get its dimension, and you can have that augmented into that spot to see what it looks like,
and discover that
you don't want it.
Your lack of taste.
It doesn't really matter anyway.
Yeah.
So, but that's going to be the case with buying anything. People will be able to do that with your painting soon. They'll be able to put it up on the wall and see whether they like it before they buy it.
Well, they can do that already. Just they come can. Around just to the studio around. And grab one.
Not if they're in Coffs Harbour or Como. So that's about it with the iPhone, new iPhone coming out.
You know what's happening with iPhones, of course, is not only the iPhone itself, but the attachments that you can add to a camera on an iPhone are getting more and more interesting all the time. Not only little tripods to stand the camera up, but lenses and all sorts of stuff that one would normally associate with a camera. I'm currently sporting an iPhone 7. And without wanting to promote a product or anything, it's frankly the best camera I've ever owned, and it's a phone as well, coincidentally.
No, the camera aspects is quite extraordinary. What you can do.
I've always liked black and white photography,
and you can do it on your
You can do it quite marvelously on the phone.
Okay, well look, that's that.
You still got to hold it up to your ear though. Although some people don't like doing, some people hold them away from their head and like on an angle away from their ear or something. You see that a lot, people walking around with it.
You should not have the phone close to your face.
Why not?
Because you're getting radiated.
By what?
If you spend a lot of
time
on the
phone. By phone rays.
If you spend a lot of time on the phone, you should use plugs or put on the chorus, what do you call it, the speaker, so that you're not holding to your face.
Well, for the same reason, you shouldn't walk down a city street, because the fumes coming off the traffic are
or a truck trying to run you down.
Well, no, just the fumes coming out of the traffic is going to be worse for you than a phone.
It's not true, John.
Really? Phones are worse than...
You're using your phone all the time. If you're using your phone all the time, you should definitely not have it on your ears.
And what would all the time mean?
Anyway, I'm bored with phones now. I'm going to read you a poem. And it's called The Fly.
Are we going to allow this, Brody?
Well, Brody hasn't been here, so he hasn't had to put up with my poems. So,
right.
So but there's no sex in this one.
That's Brody, what he said last time.
The Fly. He was a young chap, undersized, fresh, and relatively clean, if one ignored the fact he had 30 million microorganisms in his gut and 500 million more swarming over his body. I had no idea what he was doing there, as it was the middle of winter. The house was cold, clean, no food except for an apple, and I was alone. Nevertheless, there he was, flitting lightly to and fro, investigating paintings, mirrors, books, and sculptures. So I let him be as I was occupied, until the moment he landed on the apple I had cut in half, and with the taste receptors on his legs, thought my pink lady was good, vomited up a drop of his last meal, whose providence it's perhaps better not to know. Sucks most of the material up again, leaving millions of bacteria like typhoid, tuberculosis, or 30 other infectious diseases swarming in that fly speck on my apple. Not really wanting to catch typhoid, I took the travel section of the Weekend Australian, and thinking I will never get to Reykjavik, and though the poor fly was young and innocent, swiped him, reflecting how this was probably 20 days before his allotted lifespan, and what murderers we are to stay healthy or win money. When suddenly he reappears on my arm, so I whack him again. He falls to the table, gossamer wings gone, but still walking, investigating, indomitable. I smashed him this time again with the travel section of the Weekend Australian and wondered if I would ever get to Kyoto.
Excellent.
That's it?
That's a lot of microbes you're talking about there.
Yeah, yeah.
But they won't do you any harm, Mark.
No, we need them, that's true. You're quite right. We're too clean these days, apparently. Mm. So, you want more, or you've had enough?
No, no, that's enough of a poem for today. I think we can get away with that. But Brody, shall I play another song? What do you think? Are you ready for that? Now, you'll enjoy this, I'm sure. We're all familiar with the song, but it's here, given to us by a couple of characters.
And will I be able to play a song or not? We have time.
You didn't bring any music, is
it? No, we don't need it. It's the 4 minutes and 37 seconds of silence of John.
No, you can only play that if you bring it in on a recording. Now, here we go. Thank you, Swanee. Mark.
Yes, John.
When I was younger, well, not that much younger, this is not all that long ago, but not that it's relevant, I became aware of a yacht sailing around on Port Phillip, which I think I'm happy to name was the was called the Acrospire 3, and the Acrospire 3 is a classic Port Phillip sailing yacht, about 60 something foot. It's a cutter.
Not one of those catamarans they use in the America's Cup.
No,
no.
It's a wooden sloop, cutter rigged.
How many masts?
One mast, but three headsails and a big topsail, and the mainsail was huge, absolutely huge. And I used to watch this thing getting around. And I got to know the guy who owned it, and I knew that the big weekend of sailing was coming up, the ANA weekend, and where they race yachts from Hobson's Bay in Melbourne down to Corio Bay in Geelong, and then spend the weekend down there having fun. And
do they do alcohol testing in yachts? Sorry, are they? Do they do that?
Not that I've ever noticed.
No. I mean, so you can be as drunk as you like and sailing a yacht.
Well,
basically,
the Acrospire 3 had an icebox on it that carried 200 cans of beer. So
I know, because my small experience with sailors has been that they start the day with a beer,
it's a very familiar noise when boats are sailing around. That the sound that can only be made by an aluminium ring pull being torn off a can of beer. Anyway, I suggested to this guy that I'd like to have a ride on his boat down to Geelong, and he said, "Yep, that's great. You know, why don't you come along? 7 o'clock in the morning down at Hobson's Bay," and we went out and got on the boat. Beautiful day from blowing from the north, which blew us down Port Phillip and around a few marks and down to a mark that is essentially, as you go around it, you point the boat up Corio Bay, and it's more or less a straight line from there to the Geelong Yacht Club in Corio Bay. You've got to go past Point Henry on the way, but apart from that, it's pretty well a straight sail. So we got up there, we turned the boat around this mark, this boat is absolutely beautiful. You know, you've got no idea unless you see this.
A cutter is a the clippers were the American boats.
Yeah, nowhere near the size of a clipper, but it's a racing boat, a Port Phillip from the 1920s racing boat. We went around this mark, and if you had a film of the boat going around this mark, you would add a soundtrack of a car screeching around a corner. You know, it was sort of the tyres screeching. It was that kind of turn. And we went around the corner, and as we did, the wind pretty well shifted around to the southwest, which it normally does that time of the day, into Corio Bay. And so pushed the boat from the other... We'd had it on the aft quarter, and we've got it on the forward quarter, and the boat's in completely different trim. And the owner said to me, "Would you like to steer the boat?" And I said, "I would, very much." And so he gave me the helm, gave me the tiller steered boat. And we were pressed and heeling over to the point where the boom was crashing into the water. And every time it did so, it would send a shudder through the boat that was a bit disturbing, this kind of thumping shudder all the way through the rig and the rest of the boat. So I asked the mainsail trim guy to see what he could do about it, and he came over and got onto the main sheet, and I thought that he would pull the boom in, but instead he let it out a little bit and had the boom just dragging in the water, so that the boat was heeled over with two wakes coming off it, one off the boat and one off the boom dragging in the water, and it just steadied the boat to the point where it was almost static in its course through the water. A beautiful thing. Mm. Very heeled over. I was standing with one foot on the wall of the cockpit pit and one foot on the floor, the rest of the crew were all sitting along the weather rail with their legs hanging over the side, sort of sitting on top of the weather rail. And the boat going absolutely beautifully. And I got into this thing in my head where I'm just trying to find the perfect place where the rudder was dragging the least and the boat was performing the best. And it's a really lovely thing to do on a big boat like that. And I eventually got to this sort of zen thing where I'm zen with the wind and the boat and everything's absolutely beautiful, you know. And I got into a kind of a trance. I did notice that I sent a 16-year-old boy that we had on board up to the front, up to the bow, to make sure that I wasn't going to hit anything where I couldn't see on the lee side, and he was up there looking around the front. And I just let the boat go, until I realised with horror that I was getting actually quite near to the yacht club pier and the moorings. I was sailing this thing through the moorings in Geelong, a 60-foot classic yacht through the moorings under full sail, with the boy up the front kind of waving madly as we went past boats. I couldn't slow the boat down because to let the boom out and spill the wind out of the mainsail would have meant crashing the boom into parked boats. So we had to stay where we were. The owner, who was sort of standing up near the mast, he looked over his shoulder, and I think you would have to describe his face as ashen. And he kind of stumbled down back towards me along the deck, and I thought, oh, he's going to come and grab the tiller off me, you know. And I thought, I'm not sure we've got time to hand over the tiller. So I sort of put my hand up to stop him walking towards me, and I could see that there was a gap between the moorings and the pier, and I just had a guess at it, and I plunged the tiller down, and the boat went on this beautiful, great big arc and ended up standing upright and quivering in the wind as it was heading into straight into the wind. And the 16-year-old on the bow, we were close enough to the pier for him to throw a rope to someone who was standing on the pier and secure us. It was a beautiful parking job, I have to say.
So you weren't invited back on, I imagine.
Well, I didn't want to get back on, but after they were so busy packing the boat up that I don't think anyone noticed me sweating and shaking as I recovered from it. But I did sleep on the boat. I slept on the deck of the boat overnight. And in the morning, there was the slap of a newspaper on the deck next to my head. And I sat up and picked up the Geelong Advertiser. And there was a picture of the Acrospire 3. And it said underneath, "The Acrospire 3 hard pressed up Corio Harbour." Which was lovely.
Well done.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, look at your...
And I'd show you that newspaper, except I think one of my kids lit a fire with it.
Yeah, I'm sure, lit a joint with it. I would keep you off my boat, because your boat, your sailing stories have always end up... You know, they end up...
Near misses.
Near misses, exactly. I don't know how many of those you can have.
Yeah. Beautiful thing, that boat. I dream about it sometimes, about sailing it.
No, when you talk about the moment of Zen in the cockpit...
Yeah.
I can, which is strange. Why is it called cockpit? It hasn't been feminized into, yoni pit?
I don't know. I've got no idea why they call it that. But nautical terms are often odd, you know. And there are some that I was going to mention, but I won't because we're on air, you know.
Okay. Helm comes from where?
Don't know.
No, okay. No. I have to look that up.
Yeah,
but that's when you're talking about that Zen moment where everything just sort of sits into place. It's that moment of grace, which is such that extraordinary.
Grace is a good word.
Yeah,
and I think when a boat is heading up to wind, up towards the wind, and the sails are operating like wings, and it's getting sucked up to the wind as much as it is getting blown along.
Well,
and the tendency is for the boat to want to go into the wind.
Mm.
And if you've got control of the rudder, the rudder will often get quite heavy as it drags
and then you
behind
feel that
the boat.
Light.
But if you can get it into the right spot, you'll lose all the weight out of the rudder and the boat moves along quite beautifully.
Yes. Yeah, so it's the same when you're surfing and get that perfect moment in the tube, where there's suddenly it's silent.
A little bit of gurgle.
Well, just the sound of the board slipping through the water, and you get this. It's almost as if you're sort of stuck in time.
Yeah,
it's an extraordinary feeling. I'm sure people feel that when they play tennis or squash, when you get right on the right moment, it's almost as if you're not doing it yourself. You're just following.
In the groove.
But it is an amazing feeling. And, slipstreams, you can have that as well. But I think
all sorts of people.
Well, the thing about sailing, obviously, is that you've got such a heavy mass being pushed along.
Mm.
So it's quite extraordinary how it doesn't...
The bigger the boat, the better the feeling.
I don't know about container ships, whether they get that feeling. I guess they do.
They don't sail container ships. I don't think they get...
But they do catch waves, though, don't they? Wasn't that story about Queen Mary going through those monster waves and they're going up and down troughs? They do actually sail in a way, don't they?
I spoke to a ship captain who told me that he was driving a ship across the Southern Ocean and there was a massive sea. And he said the sea was so big that he plunged the bow of this ship into a wave. And the ship just kept going downwards until it got to the point where it could do nothing but come up. And as the bow started coming back up out of the water, it more or less bent the ship. He said all the rails along the side of the ship just went pop, 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 and all blew off all the way down the ship and lost a couple of containers as they rolled off the top. That's a big sea.
That's a big sea. Well, it's like those clipper ships that used to they'd get from New York to or San Francisco to Melbourne in 43 days.
Well, New York to San Francisco during the gold rush, it was very important to get around there really quickly.
Yeah.
And they did.
Because they went as far south as possible, no, before they'd
there
come.
There was no Panama Canal.
No, so they had to go all the way around Good Hope and then they'd get as close to the Antarctic as possible, no, to get the Roaring Forties. Then they'd come along and some of them disappeared because they were...
Quite a lot of them disappeared.
Mm.
But the owners of the successful ones became immensely wealthy.
And famous.
Yeah. And you're right, they used to come out here as well, the Clippers.
Yeah, I think the record was 43 days, which is extraordinary when you think before it was taking them 6 months.
Yeah, 43 hours, of course, these days.
Which or is less. Brings me to the America's Cup catamarans, which we saw.
Oh, yeah, aren't they great?
Oh, they're extraordinary, just extraordinary. How fast do they go? They're about
faster than the wind.
Oh, that's the other thing I want to say. Do you know the wind actually doesn't blow, it sucks.
Yeah, that's right.
And this is why, so Bob has to change his song. It can't be blowing him, it has to be, it's called Sucking in the Wind. Good luck, Bob.
Yeah.
And if anybody gets a chance, listen to his acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize, which he did 3 hours before time so he could get his $1 million. It's like a rap.
So do you think it was that mercurial on his behalf, that he just wanted the money?
No, really I don't. Well, look, I don't think he has any problems with money, Bob, these days. But I think it'd be crazy. It doesn't matter how much you've got, another million's not going to go astray.
And any form of plagiarism on Bob's behalf is just payback, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I mean, he'd be the most quoted songwriter ever.
Probably. Maybe, don't know. All right, so where are we going from here?
Well, you wanted to talk about a couple of things, as I remember it. We can chuck a song in, if you like. No,
John
Brody
Cage's...
says, no, the man behind the curtain
I want to
refused.
Get the 4 minutes and 37 seconds of silence. How much time do we have? I've got maybe just a quick poem.
Now, look, before you read the poem, we've got...
They're not poems anyway, they're just short prose stories.
We have... And Archbishop Le Pen to talk about. George Pell. Which
yes,
is quite...
I'm feeling sorry for him. I think he's going to be massacred and before he's even proven guilty.
Well, the media will have a lovely time.
Well, the media's going to have a lovely time. But apparently the difference between Australia and America is that in America, when they think there's going to be a biased jury, the jury can be questioned. Whereas in Australia, it's against the law to question the jury. So the big problem is, of course, social media, that they're all, everyone's going to be pumped up.
What do you mean by questioned?
You can question the juror to see if he's have a bias towards me. If he was a...
So you test the juror.
Well, if he was a Catholic, or if he was an altar boy, for example, in Ballarat, perhaps he's not the best juror for George.
Right.
Okay.
But you do still get to select a jury out of more jurors than you're going to need, don't you?
I think so, yeah, because they're kept...
Well, actually, I've done jury service and...
Well, I've never have.
...been rejected.
Right. Well, the other thing is that they could just have a judge. He could be judged only by judge, no jurors, jury. But I don't know. I don't think that's going to happen. But it's a complex thing. It's going to be quite complex. And I do feel sorry for George that it's going to be very difficult for him to have an unbiased...
Well, there's very little hard evidence, I would have thought, so to speak.
I don't know. I haven't. I wasn't there in Ballarat, thank God. But I do. I did have a Catholic education, and unfortunately, it's rife. The whole reason that priests are celibate is not for their spiritual uplifting. It's because for inheritance reason, if priests had children, the church would be losing all of its real estate, which is its biggest...
Well, but the priests don't own the real estate, do they?
No, but they'd still, they're part of the church, so their children, their offspring would have to be looked after.
They are the biggest property owners in the world, I think.
They are.
The Catholic Church.
And they have some beautiful spots. But the Catholic Church has a lot to answer for.
Now listen, Brody, how come I don't get another song to play? What is that? You're pointing at the clock. Oh, we've run out of time. Is that the end music?
That's it, John. You did.
Good Lord.
So look, I think
just about to hit the pier.
Next week, we'll get John Cage in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to get away with that. We might have to listen to just a bit of it.
Okay, yeah, we can have
a sampler.
A sampler, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do that.
Okay, now listen, I've got something being handed to me here.
Looks like news.
Oh, no, look, this is, if I were Sally Bailey, this would be the way out of here. If you've just turned in, you've missed Arts About. but you can catch up with the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website sometime in the future.
The show
is also repeated on air and streaming Wednesdays at 12. You'll find a link to our Facebook page on the 3RPPFM webpage. Please join us again, 11 a.m. next Sunday. I know Mark wants you to. Remember, we may not know everything about art.
What art?
Yeah, what art, you know. Go to Fed Square, see what you think.